From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Israel unleashed another wave of airstrikes across the Gaza Strip today. The offensive continues despite international pressure to end the attacks against Hamas, the militant group that has fired thousands of its rockets at Israel from Palestinian territory. The BBC's Paul Adams joins us now from Jerusalem. And Paul, there is talk that a ceasefire could be possible here in the next day or so. What are you hearing?
Well, that's right, Peter. This is talk that we've been hearing now for a good 24 to 48 hours. First of all, with Palestinian officials from the militant organization Hamas saying that they expect to have a ceasefire in place within the next day or so. No confirmation from the Israeli side at all. But it is worth noting that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is convening his security cabinet. That is his inner cabinet. That is the forum in which important decisions about this operation take place. And if there is to be an announcement about a ceasefire, it would have to be discussed there first. So I think we should keep an eye on that.
Do we know yet what the terms of a ceasefire could be?
We do not, and they are likely to be complicated because each side obviously has key demands. From Israel's point of view, it wants to be sure that it is going to have a protracted period of peace and quiet. And by protracted, I mean years. That's what they're looking for. For Hamas, it's a slightly different picture. In some ways, they've already achieved some of their objectives, which is to be seen by fellow Palestinians as, you know, if you like, the staunch defenders of Palestinian rights, including in places like Jerusalem. And it may be that they will be demanding some guarantees about the access of Jewish militants onto the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the compound surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. I mean, they may have a string of demands of that kind, which I'm guessing the Israelis will not be terribly interested in. But the other key thing to bear in mind here is that money will be involved. That's where Qatar will probably play a role, with probably large pledges to invest in rebuilding Gaza.
Well, speaking of international diplomatic pressure, what was the impact there in Israel on President Biden's statement yesterday to Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that he expected a significant de-escalation? That was his boldest statement yet on this conflict.
Yeah, it sounded pretty stern at the time. You know, he said he expected a significant de-escalation today. That was yesterday. But then he added on the path to a ceasefire. There certainly was no significant de-escalation, at least not from the Israeli side. There was an 8-hour pause in rockets from Gaza into Israel during the night, which some people regarded as possibly significant, an indication of a willingness of Hamas to stop this. But I think it was definitely a clear sign that the White House, which has been pretty resolute in defending Israel's interests so far, keeping the UN Security Council at bay and so forth, that the White House was beginning to lose patience.
Did it make a difference?
I think inevitably it will have made a difference. I think there's a set of calculations that always happens in these situations. International pressure, particularly from the United States, the kind of humanitarian outcry at the rising casualty toll among civilians and particularly children, but also, and this is crucial, Israel's own assessment of where it has got with its operation. And I was speaking to a military official yesterday who said that they had achieved more in just over a week than they did in 7 weeks back in 2014 when we were last in this situation. So the Israelis do feel that this has been an extremely successful campaign. And so I think there will be, I think, a willingness to say, okay, we've done enough damage. We've knocked back Hamas potentially for years. We've sent a very, very strong message to them. That's enough for now.
So what is your sense then of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's strategy, his political calculations, now that a ceasefire could be on the brink here and we are in the 11th day of this conflict?
Well, you know, this came at a time of political deadlock in Israel. Mr. Netanyahu had been offered the first opportunity to put together a government following the last set of elections here. He'd failed to do that. The opportunity had been given to his opponents. They were in the process of trying to cobble together a coalition. And then this crisis erupted and all of that came to a halt. The conventional wisdom is that this has been good for him, that he has been seen to be leading the defense of the country at a time of some peril in which Israeli civilians have been in danger. And so he does emerge strengthened in that sense. I think it's probably too cynical to suggest, as some have, that he engineered the entire thing for precisely that purpose. But I think it's fair to say that Mr. Netanyahu emerges strengthened, but the coalition negotiations will have to resume among his opponents before he has another opportunity, perhaps, to seize the reins of power. So it's a little early to say whether Mr. Netanyahu's political fortunes, which seem to be pretty much at an end, have been revived by this.
BBC diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reporting from Jerusalem. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., one chamber of Congress, the House, has given a go-ahead for a 9/11-style commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. But top Republicans in the Senate have already said they are not interested. 35 Republicans joined House Democrats yesterday to approve the commission, but Mitch McConnell, the party's leader in the Senate, said he thinks the commission is unnecessary. So what's next? NPR's Claudia Grisales has been following this. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
So 175 House Republicans voted against forming the commission, but 35 voted with every Democrat. So does anything surprise you?
I do think that was a larger number than we expected when the negotiations were ongoing. They really dragged out for several weeks. It was unclear if a deal could be reached with any Republicans. Leaders in the House had appointed their top members on the House Homeland Security Committee to negotiate on this deal. And one of those key players was New York Congressman John Katko. And he was the first name out of the gate in terms of reaching this deal. And then we, of course, had heard of Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who had supported the commission after she had been ousted from her leadership role. She said it should focus on January 6th. And this was kind of the dividing line for other Republicans. Mm-hmm. But the floodgates opened, if you will, when we saw the 35 compared to what we expected. Not a lot of members had expressed that they would support it. They had really held close to their vest what they were going to do. This includes Rodney Davis of Illinois. He is the top Republican on one of these committees that oversees Capitol Police. He's been a big critic of Democrats and how they've responded to the insurrection. And we saw other members like Davis who focus on law enforcement issues, who wanted to make a stand here and say they wanted to support this idea of a commission, like Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. So it was surprising to see, even though it's a small share, to see even 35 vote with Democrats for this.
Well to underscore what you're saying, only 10 House Republicans voted with Democrats for former President Trump's second impeachment. That was over his role in that insurrection. So compared to 35 now, do you think this reflects at all on former President Trump's hold over the GOP?
It may not. For example, Cheney was one of those members who voted for the impeachment, and we saw her ousted from her role as the number three House Republican for speaking out against Trump again and again after that vote, and more recently on this commission proposal. So in some ways, we expected those members, of course, to join in. But this issue does fall on law enforcement. This is a topic that is very near and dear to Republicans. And so in this case, it is a bit expected, if you will, for some of these additional Republicans to break away. Whether this signals that Trump's influence over the party is waning, that is hard to say. We are seeing more members speak out, as we mentioned with Cheney and others against Trump. But it remains to be seen, perhaps on some other issues, on whether they'll break away again from the president, former president.
Well, now the measure, moves to the Senate, where Mitch McConnell has said he doesn't support it. Remind us, how many Republican votes do Democrats need, and what are the chances?
Yes, evenly divided chamber. So 50 Democrats will need 10 Republicans to step forward and vote for it. And yes, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he is bringing it to the floor regardless. He has started that legislative process to do that. But it remains to be seen if Democrats can get those 10 Republicans. With McConnell already saying he was opposed, this may tilt things against the commission in terms of getting through that Senate floor.
Yeah, we only have about a minute and a half. But if this commission, releases its findings, they could be during an election year. If the Senate torpedoes the commission idea. Democrats could campaign calling it a cover-up for Trump. And if this commission is approved, Democrats have said they could subpoena Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy to testify about a phone call he had with then-President Trump while the insurrection was unfolding. So what's at stake here for McCarthy, for Republicans?
Oh, there is a lot at stake. We have heard moderate Republicans such as Susan Collins of Maine in the Senate say, you know what, if we're going to do this commission, let's get it done this year, get it out of the way, create kind of that space before the election year. And that is what the commission sets out to do, to have its report due by year end. That all said, there are a lot of concerns here with McCarthy potentially facing, if this commission goes through, some sort of call to testify, if not a subpoena. And members of his own party have conceded to this. So there is some risk there.
And that's a call that he made to then-President Trump while the insurrection was going on. There's been anecdotal discussion of what that report was about, but what that call was about, but he may be asked to speak under oath about it.
Right.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Amanda Gorman is now a household name. In 2017, she became the nation's first youth poet laureate, and her performance at this year's inauguration of President Biden was seen around the world.
The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Four teenage poets are now in the running to follow in Amanda Gorman's footsteps as this year's National Youth Poet Laureate, and the winner will be announced tonight. The laureate is chosen based on their commitment to artistic excellence, civic engagement, and social justice, and we reached out to the finalists to hear their poetry. First up, representing the West Coast, is 18-year-old Alexandra Nguyen of Sacramento, California.
I am a Vietnamese-American poet. And I grew up really introverted, so I spent a lot of time in my head. And poetry for me was a way to process my emotions and share it with people in a way that felt very safe for me, because for poetry in particular, I feel like it allows me to not have the right words. In fact, as long as I'm able to describe my emotions in some sort of imagery or sound, or even into the silence that I build into my poems, I feel that I'm able to show what's happening on the inside of my head on the outside, so to speak.
And here's Alexandra Nguyen's poem titled Life Cycle of a Catcall.
But because you view my body as invitation to comment, I must now remember that I am a woman. I stop to be polite. First mistake. If you really wanted to, you wouldn't ask. Now ask me what I want. No, really. His words will decay in your chest, but you'll survive the bloat. That's what scares me. Today, I considered a steaming bowl of noodles and imagined how, in tipping it over like a chess piece in resignation, my mother would mount the mess with towels and a practiced speed, and I would watch, still, letting the hot liquid spill into my lap until I felt clean. Who knows what might happen if this body felt any less like mine? Some lauded metaphors, probably, and an excavation of the self. I am not nearly as brave as I sound in those "I'm so sorry he made you uncomfy" texts I send all my girlfriends. I've got flight instinct. Maybe this is my reckoning, the one where my skin finally loosens from its frame, conceding the nervous mess of flesh as inky shame leaks from every orifice, and every day I abandon the body so I may exist in spite of it. Shirts hang from me like flags on unclaimed nation, and my hair becomes freight in tow. I am a parade. I am the object of the sentence, so now everything happens to me, and none of it is my fault.
Seventeen-year-old Alora Young of Nashville, Tennessee, represents the South, and she tells us she often uses poetry to explore her personal history as a Black American.
Like, I discovered the family that owned my family in West Tennessee, and I found out that the enslaver had two daughters, and he had two sons who fought against each other in the Battle of Fort Pillow, and the son with his Caucasian wife actually was a part of the massacre that killed his son with his Black wife. And I don't know how I would have been able to cope with that information if I wasn't doing it through poetry, because in creating art out of something, it forces you to feel more than just the rage.
Today, Alora Young is reciting an excerpt of her poem titled On Kurdistan.
Kurdistan was there for us. Now we let their streets run red. You can't bury history beneath a fig tree. It hunts you and it haunts you. And it begs you to see the people beneath the too dark for airport skin. But we'll never call it genocide because brown people are only 2/3 human. Abraham didn't fight for this. He spread love of a many named God in a book that we rewrite for this. The rift that between us and them is a savior we repackaged powder white in white hoods. It's how we recycle fascist regimes like they're plastic goods. I'm mad that we value turtles more than Moors. I'm mad that we're fighting each other to hide from bigger wars. I'm mad that we have us and them and the centuries they span. And all I have left is prayer for Kurdistan.
Representing the Midwest is 19-year-old Faye Harrison of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I'm an alcoholic. I'm very open about being in recovery. I'm actually 3 years sober. And I used poetry. That was a big thing to help with my healing. I'm also a high school dropout, which I'm very open about. And I feel like those are incredibly stigmatized identities. And for me, I've used poetry a lot as a way to talk about those identities and to make it okay within myself, because I think that it can be really scary. When I was 16 and I was I need to get sober, it was really scary. And poetry was a way for me to say there's nothing wrong with it. It's a disease, alcoholism and addiction, it's a disease.
And this is the poem Faye Harrison wanted to share with us.
This is Portrait of the Alcoholic in Home Depot after Kava Akbar. My shift starts at 5 a.m. I watch the sun rise from inside a junction box, reach for the throne of clouds drifting above the Aldi's parking lot. I tell my coworker, I am a child of construction. In my family, we build houses just to tear them apart again. I understand the necessity of the wrecking ball, sitting in my auntie's deserted driveway, the cracked foundation and rotten floorboards, the roof's sudden introduction to the basement. This is a home uninhabitable, even for a ghost. I am alone when the pink walls peel from the living room.
Last but certainly not least, representing the East is 19-year-old Serena Yang of Queens, New York.
My family immigrated from Singapore, which is where I was born, to Queens when I was in the middle of first grade, and I've been raised here ever since. I identify as Chinese, as Asian American, although I'm not sure if I'm interested in being American. I am more so interested in being part of a political lineage of Asian Americans who are invested in the liberation of colonized peoples. Also, I have been identifying as a poet lately, but I don't know if privately I really feel like a poet. I think of it more like I write poetry. In the near future, I may also be writing poetry, or I may not. I want to move through the world with a lot of love for my people, and that work may look like poetry right now, but it may not in the future.
Here's Serena Yang's poem titled, Last Night, I Dreamed of Chinatown.
Last night, I dreamed of Chinatown. Grand Street dried fish ama told the cop to guan dan, and the cop cowers, because in Dream Chinatown, the police are afraid of 4'9" Chinese grandmas. Last night, I dreamed of Chinatown, and no one harassed Grand Street dried fish grandma, or Mulberry fake Gucci grandma, or Mott Street bakery grandma. In Dream Chinatown, Mott Street ama gave me free white rabbits and a bucket of paint, and I vandalized every hip new shop and canal. I painted the zodiac with overgrown horns and barbed mother tongues and unbound bleeding feet. A hissing snake swallowed the new art gallery whole. A cow sat on the luxury development and flattened it. Overnight, I made canal ugly again, impolite, made it stink of fish and counterfeit everything. In Dream Chinatown, Grandma got her heat and water back. Grandma dug a hole back home and fell through the earth to the far side of Bayard. In Dream Chinatown, people bowed, 90 degrees, eyes on your feet, filial piety in the curve of your back. In Dream Chinatown, squares of laundry flapped like wings from fifth floor windows. Youtiao and Daping sold on the side of the road for $1.50. I walked arm in arm with Grandma down Mott, and she said, "I am happy you grew up here." Last night, I dreamed of Chinatown, and the streets were paved with gold. Last night, I dreamed of Chinatown. I dreamed the children home like a monsoon, and the swampland grew wet and green again.
That was Serena Yang, Faye Harrison, Alexandra Huyn, and Alore Young, finalists for the title of National Youth Poet Laureate. The winner will be announced tonight and streamed in partnership with the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Millions of people in the United States are getting vaccinated, but millions of Americans also live abroad, many of them in countries where access to vaccines is limited and infection rates high. As we hear from Michael Sullivan in this story that first aired on Morning Edition, many overseas Americans are desperate for the U.S. government to help them.
Thailand has vaccinated less than 2% of its population, even as infection rates this month have reached new highs. And that scares many Americans living here who are desperate to get jabbed.
President Biden made a very public announcement that all Americans would have access to vaccines. And overseas, there are literally hundreds of thousands of Americans who do not have access to vaccines right now. And we're thinking, what are we, chop liver?
That's Paul Risley, chairman of Democrats Abroad Thailand. He says he's happy the U.S. government took the lead in finding vaccines. He just wants Americans abroad included. And on this point, there is rare bipartisan agreement. Here in Thailand, anyway.
Look, I'm 100% behind our common push to get Americans vaccinated by the embassy.
Tony Rodriguez lives in Bangkok and is vice president for Republicans Overseas Asia.
I'm sure a lot of people realize it's a bit difficult sometimes for Democrats and Republicans to work together, but I thought this was a great opportunity to do something together, and we're all Americans.
Last month, they sent a letter to Secretary of State Tony Blinken asking that Thailand become a pilot program for vaccinating U.S. citizens abroad, for whom a 16-hour flight home is too daunting, too dangerous, or too expensive. Paul Risley.
I have two small children, 10 and 7. We would all have to go together. We would have to be tested several times. We would probably have to find a place to stay for 4 weeks while we are getting vaccines number one and number two. Then on the return to Thailand, we would have to spend 2 weeks in mandatory hotel quarantine.
All in, he says, even if the family managed to stay with relatives, it'd cost them at least $10,000 and 6 to 7 weeks minimum. Tony Rodriguez of Republicans Overseas.
I'm 60, and a lot of my friends are in their 60s and their 70s, even their 80s, and I'm very concerned about them as well. Not all of them have the wherewithal to fly home, and they have really very limited options.
But some have gotten very creative in finding a hack.
My name is Ruben L. Sushman. I'm originally from New York and worked in finance and Wall Street for about almost 20 years.
Sushman lives in Bangkok, and at the end of April, with cases there spiking, he flew to the closest U.S. soil he could find, on the Pacific island of Guam, where he had his choice of U.S. vaccines.
You can get any of them. There's plenty of supply here.
He chose Pfizer, and while he did have to quarantine on arrival in Guam, he says the U.S. government paid for it.
So for 2 weeks, nice hotel on the beach, full internet, full food, 3 meals a day. They'll do your laundry, and it's 100% free.
And it's a lot closer and a lot cheaper than flying all the way back to the States, though he'll still have to quarantine for 2 weeks on arrival in Thailand. But the issue is on the White House's radar. Here's Press Secretary Jen Psaki last week.
We have not historically provided private health care for Americans living overseas, so that remains our policy, but I don't have anything to predict in terms of what may be ahead.
Americans here in Thailand hope it's change. And after a conversation last week with an embassy official here, Republicans overseas Tony Rodriguez was upbeat.
I don't know. I'm starting to get a little bit optimistic that something may actually happen.
For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
The fighting between Israel and Palestinians in the Gaza Strip continues. We're not any closer to a two-state solution in the region, a Palestinian and Jewish state living side by side. We're going to be hearing over the course of the next few weeks from a variety of voices who've been reflecting on the long, painful history here. Today, we want to welcome Imam Taymullah Abdur-Rahman, chaplain at the Massachusetts Department of Corrections, who wrote a piece for member station WBUR's Cognoscenti op-ed collection titled, "I'm a Man of Faith, but I don't know if I believe anymore that peace is possible." Imam Tay, as you're called, welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And give us some context. You say you believe Israel has a right to exist right there. That puts you outside of many of your fellow Muslims who view you as a pawn. Explain more about that.
Right. Well, I think we're beyond the point where we can kind of debate about whether they deserve to exist or not. I mean, obviously, they've been there for half a century. They have a right to exist. I mean, I think the problem with it is that many people think of the Holocaust when they think of the Jews, and they think that's the start of whatever kind of reaction that the Jews may have had. But I mean, they have a deep history. And essentially, anti-Semitism started back in the biblical times, and then, of course, the Holocaust. Mm. So I think all of these things have to be taken into context when we're talking about the Jewish people as a civilization are deeply traumatized and deeply afraid, you know, being surrounded by their enemies in the Middle East.
Yeah, so you have some sympathy and have long had hope and faith that something could be worked out here. But you talk about this recent incident, which we know was triggered by Israeli police coming to the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, cutting the wires to loudspeakers during the call of prayer, as you write, in the middle of Islam's most holy month, Ramadan, during a most sacred week, Eid. And it was a provocation in your view and in the view of many. And then there were also Palestinians being evicted from their homes for Jewish settlers. But you also point to just what you see as an unnecessary level of violence. Why is it that you've suddenly lost your faith?
You know, there's always been the expectation that Israel being a democracy in the Middle East, that they would have some restraint. And I think that, you know, some of the times that there's been an uptick of violence, you can say, okay, there's an argument for justification on either side, maybe, or perhaps, you know, for Israel, you know, they have to protect their people, their citizens. But I feel like this particular incident is just a blatant disregard for human rights, a blatant disregard for their claim to be a democracy at this point.
So once you were outside some of your fellow Muslim imams thinking, now, in criticizing Israel, you are worried about your relationship with Jewish leaders who you've befriended.
Right. But I think, you know, when people become religious leaders in this climate, this time, especially for some of the modern day imams, I think that in the West, becoming an imam has become a position of prestige and comfort and luxury. You know, you can kind of get your salary. You know, everyone loves you in the mosque. But originally, these positions were positions of threat. They were positions of danger, and they were positions of of being sometimes outside of the normalized context of what people believe or think. So, I mean, this should be expected. I would be surprised if I had never had the opportunity to speak my truth and be kind of marginalized by either side. I think this comes with the territory if you're being true to the position.
You're also a Black man in America, and you say being Black has made me repulsed by injustice of all kinds. But how does it feel as a man of faith to lose faith?
Well, I'll tell you, it's difficult because I think at this point, you know, people are calling for a ceasefire. And at this point, even a ceasefire is not good enough because it means that Palestinians are still going to be behind the proverbial eight ball, so to speak. So as a Black man, being in the position where I know that, you know, my forefathers fought for some of the social justice benefits that I have today, I feel like, you know, the violence gets in the way of the potential of the Palestinian people just improving their quality of life. So first we have to have a ceasefire, but then there has to be some focus and attention on the basic human necessities that they are deprived of.
That's Imam Taymullah Abdur-Rahman, chaplain at the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. We'll link you to his op-ed at hearandnow.org. Imam Tay, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And again, we'll be hearing from different voices as the conflict continues. Turning to the pandemic, you may remember last year when global supply chains for masks, gloves, hospital gowns fell apart. There were bidding wars for personal protective equipment. Well, now the overseas factories are back online. And as Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill reports, that's made it difficult for manufacturers who adapted to make PPE during the shortage.
Inside a warehouse in Newington, Connecticut, Milrose Mercado, Senior Vice President of Supply Chain at Hartford Healthcare, walks between two towering rows of boxes. She points to crates of masks, face shields, and gloves stacked up nearly to the ceiling.
This actually is an aisle where we've had many of our isolation gowns as well as masks. So these are products that we have actually sourced directly from China or Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam. We actually ended up sourcing in five different countries to be able to actually meet our demand.
All told, it's about $15 million worth of PPE, enough inventory to last Hartford Healthcare anywhere between 6 and 12 months. Jeffrey Flax, the group's president and CEO, says HHC wanted to stockpile all this gear to avoid repeating the medical supply chain nightmares of 2020.
In the earliest days of the pandemic, much of our supply acquisition came from China and secondarily from Italy. So the two countries who were impacted most first.
As global supplies dried up, PPE became hard to get. States were pitted against one another, and in response, some Connecticut manufacturers saw an opportunity. Traditional parts of their business were down, so they started making PPE to recoup lost profits and to help.
We built up the business all of last year to the point where we had 65 new employees, and we're running two shifts to one in the morning.
Bing Carbone, president of Modern Plastics in Shelton, Connecticut, pivoted from specialized plastic parts for knee replacements to those now ubiquitous transparent face shields that doctors and dentists wear. His company made more than 30 million of them, but once Asian markets recovered and ramped up production in the late summer and fall, he says buyers stopped calling him back.
A lot of the local institutions and hospitals, et cetera, went back to China.
Because the Chinese PPE was cheaper, which meant Carbone, who recently sent 2 million unsold face shields to sit in storage, had to make a tough call.
We leased a new facility in Derby, which I had a scuttle in March, because the business literally dried up. The employees are gone. The facility is closed.
Carbone says he'd like to make more PPE, but with few buyers, he's back to his core business, specialized plastic parts. And that leaves Colin Cooper, Connecticut's chief manufacturing officer, wondering when local PPE manufacturers close, what will happen if global markets fall apart again?
There's been discussion, you know, primarily at the federal level, on nurturing these nascent industries and helping them along. You know, there's strategically, I think there's some value, obviously, on having domestic supplies of these products. In case there's another pandemic.
But if the country wants to make investments in automation technology, efficiency, and job training to compete better internationally, Cooper says the decision needs to be made soon.
If the decision is made, you know, 9 months from now or 12 months from now to put some financial resources behind, you know, domestic purchasing, a lot of that capacity may have and capabilities may be extinguished.
Back at the HHC warehouse, supply chain manager Milrose Mercado says about 80% of the PPE her group acquired came from overseas. But she says the equipment scrambles of 2020 have workers in the supply chain business asking a question.
How do we look at domestic manufacturing and really build that into the supply line infrastructure? So I think a good blend of products that are sourced domestically plus internationally, I think would really help stabilize the supply line and ensure that there's accessibility moving forward.
Her boss, CEO Jeffrey Flack, says Hartford Healthcare wants to buy more local PPE. The company is already working with local shops who produce everything from face shields to shoe coverings. But Flack says he'd also really like to see a national stockpile for medical equipment.
We've historically had that for oil, you know, for these very types of issues where there could be disruption or risk.
Which has left individual healthcare organizations to continue staking out ground on their own, storing supplies, and hoping to never run into the problems of 2020 again. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
The U.S. House vote to create an independent commission investigating the January 6th Capitol riot revealed a crack in the Republican Party. 35 House Republicans broke ranks yesterday and joined Democrats to support the commission. And this rift in the GOP goes beyond Washington. Here in Maricopa County, Arizona, an ongoing audit of the 2020 election results has driven a wedge into the party. Last week, the Republican state senators behind the recount alleged that the county had deleted a voter registration database. It was a false claim, later picked up by former President Trump, and local Republicans are now starting to push back, including Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer, who oversees voter registration. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And before we get into some of these claims, do you think the audit should continue?
I don't know what positive outcome it could achieve at this point, because I think the credibility of the auditors has been lost with a good percentage of the Arizona public. And, you know, it just seems to go on and it's going to linger. And how far is this going to push into? So I am doubtful that it can have any positive outcome at this point.
You've been trying to correct these false claims from your fellow Republicans in Arizona that a county voter database had been deleted, and that your office has flown in fake ballots from South Korea. We know those are false, right? But how did we get to this point?
Well, we got to this point by just letting, I think, misinformation, disinformation linger, by not putting it to rest, by not categorically denouncing it, by not having prominent people stand up and say that that's simply not accurate. Some prominent people have even indulged it. And so, you know, it grows and it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. You know, for my purposes, I mean, you know, perhaps I'm culpable in some respect because I'm not a confrontational person. My MO has always been to, if it doesn't directly affect me, you know, sort of don't pick fights. But then it started directly affecting my staff, and that's when I started to get more involved, is when the allegations were leveled directly at to me and my team, and, you know, it was enough.
And you came into office in January. Is that why you didn't start pushing back against all of this sooner?
Well, the irony is that I, of course, unseated a Democrat in the very election that some Republicans are saying was completely fraudulent and was stolen. And yes, it is why I didn't get involved sooner. This wasn't my election. I didn't administer it. And truthfully, I had to learn the office. And, you know, then this politics stuff came and sort of hit me in the head.
By the former president, by the way, when Donald Trump started spreading these false claims, you punched back. You called him unhinged. Do you think at this point that it's even possible to set the record straight when someone as powerful as Donald Trump steps into the fray?
Well, I don't want to call him, but those comments were absolutely inaccurate. You know, he was obviously repeating what, you know, members of the state Senate had been propounding. And I'm not even sure if it was members of the state Senate. Let's keep in mind that this is all being done by a Twitter account that purports to represent the Arizona Senate's audit, but we don't even know who's running the Twitter account. And Senate President Karen Fann has said she has no control over the Twitter account. And then that's leading to comments from as lofty individuals as the former president of the United States.
What does the audit do for the credibility of your county's elections the next time people go out to vote?
That's a real worry. I don't know what the answer to that is. It's a real concern. I think that this audit had good intentions from many people. I think former Secretary of State Ken Bennett approached us with good intentions, and he recognized that there would be people who potentially didn't have confidence in the system. But, you know, the manner in which this audit has been conducted, the conspiracy theories that they've indulged, and now the accusations of criminality that they've leveled, you know, even this morning, a state senator said that this was a criminal investigation. And if it was about bringing confidence to the process, then that's something I believe in. But I believe it has departed from that.
Have you been thinking about your own future here? We've seen what happens to Republicans like Liz Cheney who speak out against Donald Trump and the party's orthodoxy. I mean, you know, maybe you're putting your career on the line by coming out so vocally.
Well, my career, no. My political future, perhaps, to which I say, you know, I was never going to be the politician who simply puts my finger up in the air and you know, chooses my actions based off of that. So as long as my wife is happy with me and as long as I have, you know, 5 to 10 friends, then I'll be able to be happy and I can find happiness elsewhere. I'm going to do what I think is right. I'm going to defend this office. I'm going to defend the good people in this office. And if that is not what the, you know, is healthy for me politically, then so be it.
Republican Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer calling for a stop to the Republican-led audit of the 2020 election in that county. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It is Here and Now.